Relations David Soibert has an announcement that he would like to make.
The Archaea Phone Owners Club, the first annual meeting of, will be held in room 153 tonight. So owners of Archaea phones, or people that are perhaps interested in owning Archaea phones or learning about them, are welcome to come. 153 is in the next building down in the Santa Cruz building. So see you all there at 5:45.
Thanks.
Well, welcome to the ARSC technical sessions for this conference. As most of you know, the technical committee continues to try to keep the organization abreast of latest developments and techniques for restoration and preservation, and that's what much of our sessions will be devoted to this afternoon. We have four, which I think will be extremely interesting and useful programs, beginning today with David Wexler, who is the owner of Hollywood Vaults Incorporated, and the title of his presentation is Storage and Preservation for Today and Tomorrow. David Wexler.
Thank you, Gary. Just while we're waiting for a few more people to wander in from lunch, I'm reminded, a good friend of mine who's an excellent public speaker once told me, if you're ever called upon to deliver a talk directly after lunch, that there are four things that are imperative. And he said the number one thing is to use a handout of some sort. And his thinking was that if you've got something to fiddle with in your hands, you'll stay alert. The people in the back are wondering when it's going to get back here, and that sort of thing. So he said, hand out a paper, your visuals, a business card, anything, just to have a handout going around. So I'm going to hand out some. We'll get to that. I'm going to hand out some Rolodex cards. Not that I'm trying to solicit your business, but just so you'll remember who we are, and more importantly, to direct you to our website, which is jam-packed full of useful information and links. Yeah. The second thing my friend told me was to keep the presentation lively. The third thing was to keep it funny. And the fourth thing was to keep it brief.
Are you done?
So thank you for your attention. If you have any questions, I'll be around the rest of the conference. If you'd like a copy of the paper, you can email me. Just joking. Just joking. Well, speaking of joking, Jerry Seinfeld is in town tonight. He's performing at the Arlington Theater. Two shows, 7 and 9:30. And I have one ticket. I don't know why I'm telling you this. It's probably been sold out for weeks, but I have one ticket, and it's a contest. The one person that's left awake at the end of this presentation, you'll know who you are. Just look around, and everyone else is nodded off.
If we're lucky, Shirk will win it.
Well, I'm on tonight.
That's why we're lucky.
All right,
okay. I'm already on.
He's performing at the Arlington Theater, which is one of the gems of Santa Barbara. It's just up on State Street. It's got a big tower on top. It's beautifully lit up at night. I can see it from my house. And it's just a wonderful spot. If you get a chance while you're here to just poke your head in and take a look, it's one of these grand movie palaces, big balcony. Hasn't been chopped up into a 14-plex yet. It's got a red tile roof. But then again, everything has a red tile roof in Santa Barbara, right? Just an interesting sidebar. The reason that we have red tile, we're obsessed with red tile roofs, is there was an earthquake here in 1925. It practically leveled everything in town. And the city fathers, in their wisdom, decided to rebuild with a Spanish Mediterranean theme, which means red tile roofs and white stucco walls and so on. And so we have extremely tight architectural codes here. In the last 80 years, everything that has been built has been scrutinized, and it's a terrible place to be a developer. You can't get anything built. But it, as a consequence, it looks the way it looks today because of that. For example, there's no billboards in this town. You probably weren't aware of that until someone brings it to your attention, but there's not a single billboard in town. But yeah, the Arlington Theater is, they actually take the red tile roofs to extreme and put them inside as well as outside, because it's one of these theaters that instead of boxes along the sides, it's a facade of a Spanish Mediterranean street scene. So there's little fronts of houses and balconies and wrought iron railings and red tile roofs. The seats are kind of uncomfortable and the sound system needs a little upgrading. But the coolest thing about the Arlington Theater is the ceiling has little lights in it to look like the sky. So you feel like you're outside in this Spanish Mediterranean village. So if you nod off at the Arlington and come awake and you see, look up at the sky, you think, oh my gosh, where am I? You think you're outside, but you're in the Arlington Theater. So that's just up the street. Well, that was just a little stalling, waiting for more people to trickle in from lunch. We're gonna start off with a videotape. And this was a tape. Well, there's a phenomenon in Hollywood of low-budget feature film production. Any given day in Hollywood, there's dozens of low-budget feature films being shot. My brother's a cameraman. He's worked on many of these over the years. And they shoot an entire feature film in like a week or 8 days. And these are films that maybe you never get a chance to see. They go straight to video, or they go straight to DVD, or straight to cable, or straight to the shelf, or straight to the vault. I mean, just literally dozens and dozens of these. And so they're called, let's say you take 8 days to shoot one of these, they're called an 8-day wonder. Well, what I'm going to show you here is a 1-day wonder. And we shot this on mini DV. Many of you are probably familiar with this format, relatively new format, about the size of a DAT audio tape. Incredible format in that the picture quality, the sound quality, everything about it is just remarkable, except for the fact that it uses compression. And as those of us who follow the archival world know that compression is a dirty word because it means we're throwing away information, and archivists don't like to throw away anything. But there's another thing that you'll see here for the first time today, a new type of compression. It'll be written up in the journals in the months to come. SMPTE's going to devote a whole breakout session at their next conference. We've managed to compress into 9.5 minutes everything you need to know about storage and preservation of media materials. So whether you're the custodian of audio tape or videotape or photographs or artwork or film, everything you need to know is compressed into 9.5 minutes. You don't have to read any more journal articles or any white papers. It's all covered right here. One last note, and I apologize up front for this. If any of you are copyright holders of any of the visuals or sound that we pirated for this tape, I apologize right up front. Please don't sue me. I'm not being paid for this. No money is changing hands. Well, actually, that's not true. As a sponsor, as one of the sponsors of this conference, we paid to be here. So it kind of puts a new light on pay-per-view. But this runs 9.5 minutes.
Ground Zero Hollywood. Movie Mecca. Mired in the murk of an unsavory air. On a quiet side street, an unmarked fortress. Its sole emblem belies the treasures that lie within. Agents materialize at all hours, harboring their priceless cargoes.
Access control, security clearance.
Access?
All secure.
Limited. If you permeate the first layer, it's only because you're supposed to. If you haven't got a clue, get one. From the only man who's here to give it.
Wexler. David Wexler.
If you've got a hot masterpiece, he's here to keep it cool.
Welcome. Welcome to Hollywood Vaults.
The Hollywood Vaults may appear nondescript to the uninitiated, but on the inside, it's a living, breathing machine. It was designed by David Wexler with this mission in mind: the preservation of media, the physical stuff that holds the cultural legacy of our times.
Back in the early 80s, Coppola, Scorsese, and Redford started to make the industry aware of the problems of color film fading, film degradation, due to improper storage. That's when I had my aha moment.
Aha. Today, the vaults have become a safe home, a place where the legends of our culture live to perform another encore. Laurel and Hardy, Jimmy Durante, Miles Davis, Stravinsky, Sinatra, and Judy Garland are all poised here to spin their tales once more. To some, it's pure magic. To Wexler, it's applied science.
We all love film, but film has its natural enemies: dirt, dust, heat, moisture. Add in the threat of earthquake and fire and flood, and you've entered a real high-tech battle zone. So let's take a look from the top down to discover how we win this war.
Whoa! Look at that moisture! It's coming in!
Don't tell Kevin Costner, but we all live in a water world.
I know it looks dry now, but there's moisture everywhere. And in a few months, it's gonna be like a monsoon up here.
It all starts up here on the roof. Roofs can leak. You know where they leak? They leak at seams. How do we stop leaks? We build a seamless roof.
For film and tape, moisture is public enemy number one. Around here, we really batten down the hatches.
Well, it's not really that cold, but you will need one of these.
Heat and humidity are a dangerous combination for film and tape. So we maintain 45 degrees and 25% humidity. Now that's bone dry. Bone dry.
Film has an active life from manufacture to camera, development and beyond. The film can live anywhere. The trunk of a car, a box in a warehouse, or even under the bed. By the time the film makes it to the vault, outgassing starts to occur. Byproducts from manufacturing intensify. Developing chemicals may not have been properly washed away. Acetic acid propagates. The film is literally stewing in its own juices.
That's called the vinegar syndrome, and it's where acetic acid is given off from film that is improperly stored, and it can really clear your sinuses.
Woo! Oh, boy.
Wow. Now that's a bit of brewing.
If you look closely, you can see the evidence of the damage to this film. If left unchecked,
The vinegar syndrome spreads like a virus. The film deforms, and horrendous things can happen. Most color films are made from organic dyes, and as the film begins to age, the dyes begin to fade. The cyan goes first, and you start to get that ugly, pinkish sort of look. Mold and mildew can also break down the emulsion, and eventually the film deteriorates completely. The film shrinks, becomes deformed, the oxide flakes off, and you can lose your mag tracks. It's the same with audio and video. Binders fail, and dropouts run rampant. When the distortion reaches the point where the sprocket holes can no longer hold their alignment, film can no longer be transferred.
End of show. Dirt, dust, heat, and humidity. The deadly sins of film degradation.
These conditions should never happen. Here at Hollywood Vaults, film, tape, and photographs are priceless treasures. It's important to keep them clean and pristine.
I never knew it could be like this.
The air inside the vault is being continually scrubbed using HEPA filters, carbon filters, and even molecular sieve filters. We're also using desiccant dehumidifiers to keep the air dry, and air curtains and dust filters to keep the dust out.
Sometimes life on the coast can get a little shaky. What happens when California starts to shake, rattle, and roll?
Essentially, nothing. You know, anyone who's ever moved a lot of film around knows that this stuff ain't light. But we've accommodated for that. These Swiss vaults are built like a fine watch and engineered like a tank.
The larger vaults can hold almost 5,000 cans of film and over 20,000 beta cams.
Now that's a whale of a weight.
That's right. And to support the weight of the archives, we built this building 9 times stronger than the California seismic code requires.
Shake it, baby. You're smoking. And where there's smoke, there's...
Not in here, pal. That's a Halon fire suppression system. It's gonna put out a fire on a molecular level instantly. Just follow the red pipes.
The Halon system penetrates every nook of this building, even in places like the electrical and mechanical rooms, places where fires typically can get started.
Fire will never get to our loved ones. We're all little Fonzies here. We're all gonna keep it cool.
Cold. Totally cool.
Yeah, you're way far chill, David. But bust this. Aren't you a little whack on the analog?
Good question. Digital archiving is in vogue, but audio and video formats are always in flux. Will the digital storage you use today be around in a year, or two, or 20?
Try using a floppy in an iMac lately. Will there even be an iMac in 5 years? Remember these? And let's face it, inexpensive digital archiving almost always means compression. But down the road, when newer, higher resolution formats emerge, artists and producers are going to want all the pixels they can get. They'll almost always want to go back to their full res originals.
That's why we're here. Our past and present clients have been recognized with 24 Oscars, 102 Grammys, 36 Emmys, 11 Rock and Roll Hall of Famers, and 120 Hollywood Walk of Famers. Of the top 50 albums sold in the U.S., 10% were made by Hollywood Vault's clients. These are the shining jewels of our contemporary culture. We're here for the long run, to help keep this legacy alive.
Hollywood Vaults, edge of the art archival preservation. Dedicated to sharing our legacy with future generations.
I'm often asked, what people can do to improve the quality of their storage. And when you go back to your institutions after a conference like this and you're inspired to get your archives in better shape, from a storage point of view, I would say the one thing that you could do that would have the biggest impact on preserving your collections would be to reduce the humidity, reduce the moisture level in your storage areas. That's the one most important thing that you could do. Most people don't think about that. They think about temperature-controlled vaults, oh, we gotta bring in some air conditioning, get it cold in here. But when you think about it, where have we found the oldest artifacts on the planet? We haven't located those in hot, steamy, moist jungles. We've dug them up from dry deserts. And there's something about that lack of moisture that is really critical for preserving most items. Not every item, but certainly audio tape, videotape, well, magnetic media of any flavor, optical media. So that's the one thing that you could do right off the bat. Now, it's kind of a double-edged sword because sometimes in lowering the moisture content, you tend to raise the temperature depending on how you do the drying. So it can be a little bit tricky, but it's just something to think about when you go back to your vaults and your storerooms and take a fresh look at your collections after a conference like this, is to think about what you might be able to do to keep those elements drier. The nice thing about it is that it benefits just about everything, and if you have a mixed collection of motion picture film, videotape, audio tape, scores, photographs, memorabilia, although the chemistries are different with each item, the cold, dry conditions will benefit them all. And a lot of it's just common sense. If you have a food item and you leave it out on the kitchen counter, it's going to last a day or two and then it's going to go bad. You put it in the refrigerator and it's going to last a week or two and then it's going to go bad. You put it in a freezer and it's going to last a month or two or longer. So the colder the better. And that's just, we're slowing the molecules down to a snail's pace. And the slower you can get them moving, the slower the degradation will be. On the dryness issue, let's talk about magnetic media for a moment. With magnetic media, we're talking about the glue. A friend of mine used to say, audio tape is rust glued to plastic. And it's the glue that fails. It's not the plastic. Most audio tape is polyester-based, clear polyester-based. It's virtually indestructible. It's hard to break the stuff, right? And the iron oxides, although they can oxidize, that's usually not the issue. The issue is the glue, we call it the binder, that holds the oxide onto the base. And that is hydroscopic. It absorbs moisture from the air. And the more moisture it absorbs, the less it can bond. And it gets sticky and it flakes off. And we've heard yesterday war stories about Schickisted's shed syndrome and other problems with trying to play back tapes and baking tapes to drive out the moisture. Ralph from Wonderland yesterday talked about storing tapes in very dry conditions, and we have some anecdotal evidence that if you store tapes under very dry conditions, and 45 degrees at 25%, as I said there, it really is bone dry. Humidity is talked about in terms of relative humidity. Well, relative to what? Relative to temperature. But to talk about it in terms of absolute terms, the engineers talk about it in terms of weight. They say, we have so many grams of moisture in so many pounds of air. And
25% humidity at 45 degrees, there's very, very few grams of moisture per pound of air. It is very, very dry. If you work in one of those vaults for an afternoon, your lips just fall off. So there's some anecdotal evidence that if you leave audio tape in those dry conditions long enough, you may not have to bake it. And that's a good thing, because baking tape, as Ralph said, is very tricky. It's dangerous. And it puts the tape through some physical changes by heating it up that much that may do more damage if you don't have a nice, clean wrap to it. So it's just something to think about. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes a long time to draw the moisture out. But some of our clients have experimented with that. If they have a tape that they know they're going to want to make a transfer on, they have a feeling that it's going to be problematic to go through the guides and go across the heads cleanly, they can put it on an open wire shelf out of its box and let it get lots of this nice dry air. And it may take months. And if you have the luxury of the time to do that, you may be pleasantly surprised that you won't have to bake them. If you do have to bake them, there's some papers on our website that give the recipe, very similar to what Ralph from Wonderland talked about yesterday. And there's some links on there to sources, good sources of information about that. Let's open it up for questions and see if we can't talk about some of your specific storage questions or problems.
I just wanted to ask, you mentioned the relative humidity, 45-25. How does that change, for instance, if you're very dry, but you're in the 70s and 80s?
The question is, can you trade off temperature against humidity? And yes, you can. And in fact, most of the work and the studies that have been done on that have to do with color film fading and dye fading, but it's the same principle at work with magnetic media. And IPI in Rochester, the Image Permanence Institute, publishes some nice slide charts in the form of a wheel where you can say, okay, I can't control my temperature down to 45 degrees. Room temperature is the best I can do. But I'm in Albuquerque and it's very dry here. And you can then look at how that affects the longevity of the material. And the converse is true. If you put things in a freezer where you may not have humidity control, then maybe you don't worry about it so much because you're so cold. Well, that speaks to a bigger issue of cleanliness. Before I got into this, I was a still photographer and a filmmaker, and I just knew instinctively that dust and dirt do not mix with photographs and negatives, and the same is true with the tiny, tiny little gaps between magnetic media and tape heads. And to see some of the vaults, at least in this country, they're atrocious. You'd think they just at least sweep the floor, but they don't. So we attack the cleanliness issue on many fronts. We have dust curtains at the doors. We have dust traps in the floor as you walk into the facility. We have a central vacuum system
to aid in keeping it tidy. And we do try to pick flooring material that's easy to clean and maintain. It's tricky because once you install any equipment in a vault, it's hard to come back later and do any more construction that creates dust and dirt. It's kind of like working in a commercial kitchen. Once the kitchen is up and running, you can't really come in and start ripping down drywall and painting and things like that. So the same thing is true about flooring in terms of wax and sealers and strippers and things like that. So you want to try to find something that is extremely easy to maintain, doesn't require a lot of harsh chemicals. When we first built our facility in 1985 in phase one, we decided to just go with raw concrete and seal it, just as basic and simple as possible, low maintenance. The sealer was just there so it doesn't dust. When we expanded our facility in 1995, we came back and used an epoxy terrazzo material. Most terrazzo, as you may be aware, is a very thick, cementitious product with stone, and it gets ground down, and it's used in a lot of public facilities. It's indestructible, lasts for hundreds of years. We didn't have the profile to work with, but we found a new product that uses epoxy instead of cement, and so you can pour a terrazzo floor in literally millimeters thick, and then we coat that with a clear urethane and simply use the central vacuum system and occasionally a damp mop. And we try to stay away from as many chemicals as possible. Yeah, the question is about coving corners with flooring. And that was one of the beauties that we discovered about the epoxy terrazzo, was that you can curve it up the sides of the walls and you don't have to have any baseboard. And to our surprise, we found we could also curve it down. And we have sort of a tiny little atrium, if you will, area between floors. And we were able to curve it over that edge down as well as curve it up. So it's very flexible, expensive, but a pretty bulletproof solution. We've used good old linoleum because linoleum is one of those sort of basic products, been around since the 1800s. Doesn't have any asbestos, holds up well, easy to clean, maintain. In our newest vault room, we used PVC flooring because it's built over our parking garage, and we were trying to create as much a vapor barrier as possible from the moisture coming up. And so we used seamless rolls of PVC flooring with as few seams as possible and glued it down with epoxy cement. Because remember, when you build one of these rooms that is that dry, there was always going to be a positive vapor pressure trying to get into that room, except in maybe a few spots in the world where, at least in this part of the world, it never gets below 25% humidity, except for a few days a year when the hot, dry Santa Ana winds blow over these mountains. So 99% of the time, there's always a positive vapor pressure trying to get into that room. And so the flooring became an integral part of that vapor barrier.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm sure you do. It's always seemed to me that the basic problem with creating the kind of system that you offer for other people to implement something like it is an enormous expense in electricity, which is perpetual overhead. And I'm wondering what you've done to reduce the consumption of power, because getting that humidity down is enormously expensive.
The question is, how do we address the power consumption issue? Because these are systems that are powered by mechanical means. We address it from the construction on up. If we can build a very, very tight box, a very, very tight vapor barrier, then we reduce the monthly operating expense tremendously. And for that, we look to the food service industry, and we build these rooms like walk-in coolers. And it's very cost-effective. Every restaurant, every hotel, every fast food joint has one of these things. They're modular. They're built regionally, because you don't want to ship these panels very far. They're very price competitive. And you can build a room that is extremely, extremely tight. And we've just noticed that because we had two phases. We had one phase that we built in 1985 where we used more traditional methods of creating a vapor barrier. And we have a new space we built in 95, which uses this modular approach. And we noticed that the dehumidifiers run a fraction of the time in the tighter room than they do in the older space. So that's one way we address it, is sort of built in to it. But in the coming years, we're going to look into some alternative methods of drying using carbon dioxide, gas, and some more smaller modular type vaults. So there's a few things that are coming along. But you're right. Our electric bill is our single most, is our biggest monthly expense. Yes and no. The question is UPS systems, uninterruptible power supplies. Do we have some sort of backup power? And fortunately, as all of you know, these materials in our vaults are not like a perishable food item. And if the power went off for a few hours, it's not like you lost $60,000 worth of ice cream. It's more the equivalent of taking the tape out of the vault and taking it into the studio and making a dub and putting it back in the vault. In the archival world, we call that time out of storage. So the other thing that's working in our favor is if we do build these rooms as tight as we were just talking about, there's so much thermal mass inside these vault rooms between the concrete that's constructing it, the metal shell of the vapor barrier, the steel shelving, the contents, whether it be film or tape, that it's like trying to turn around a battleship. Even if you wanted to bring the temperature up from 45 degrees to 75 degrees, you'd be hard-pressed to do that in any quick way. The other thing is that it depends on where you are, whether you're in an area that you're susceptible to brownouts and blackouts. Where we're located in Hollywood, we're in pretty good shape. We're the Department of Water and Power, which is a City of LA run utility, and we have very few brownouts and blackouts. I was a consultant on a project that Paramount Pictures built a vault quite a few years ago now. 45,000 square foot version of what you saw there, right in the middle of the Paramount Pictures lot. And they put in a huge generator and a huge tank of diesel fuel. And I said, why are you doing this? You're trying to remove these materials from hazards. Why introduce a hazard right there at the facility? I mean, not that you hear about diesel generators blowing up very often, but just to have a tank, a 500-gallon tank of diesel fuel, it just kind of gave me the willies. I thought, well, why even go to the expense? If the thing breaks down, you can get a service call within a day, and they can probably fix it within 2 days. Well, it turned out it was driven by their insurance company, and their insurance company dictated that they put it in. And you couldn't convince them otherwise.
Wouldn't most of the change have to do that you presently expense due to you were to say we have a power emergency, we're not going to let anybody in.
Yeah, the question is, wouldn't the traffic in the building be the biggest culprit? And yes, when the systems are down, the best thing to do is limit the access. The second answer to your question is we have lots of little upses around the building, battery powered ones, on lots of little systems, life safety, fire alarms, fire suppression, access control, emergency lighting. So we do that with lots of little, in fact, we just this week replaced the batteries in all of those, a periodic thing. And I think we had to order several dozen batteries because we have several dozen of these little units, just like you'd have underneath your desk at your computer, that size unit, dispersed throughout the building. Okay, I think probably everybody heard that since he was in the back. Well, Hollywood Vaults runs as a public facility, so we don't actually take in the material ourselves. We just rent space to our clients who do their own pickup and delivery and their own preparation, their own packaging, their own inventory. So we don't get directly involved with that. We do get involved with recommending to our clients sources of packaging materials, sources of vendors, and that sort of thing. But yes, there is a problem with label adhesive at that dry condition. And if you just buy any old office supply label, it may not hold up very long. And it necessitates going to a higher grade of adhesive. One of the reasons we picked 45 degrees is that we didn't want to burden our clients with having to stage the material out of storage. And it depends a little bit on where you are, what the dew point would be in your neck of the woods. I just finished a project as a consultant for Television New Zealand. And they have an extensive library that is, they wanted to access immediately. So if they had a call for a particular clip, they wanted to take it right out of the vault, put it on an uplink facility or onto fiber and ship it anywhere in the country. And they chose to go at about 57 degrees because they just didn't want to have any potential problems with condensation on the outside of the material coming out of the vault. They didn't want to have to stage it. But we find, at least in Southern California, 45 degrees, it's very rare that we have a problem with condensation coming out of the vaults. Now, we do have some 0-degree freezer space, and there we do recommend some staging. And some of our more particular clients will come in with soft-sided cooler bags, insulated bags, like you'd pick up at the camping supply store, zippered bags, and put their tape in the bag, zip it up, and transport it back to their studio in a bag. And I think it's a great idea. It provides some thermal protection. It provides some bump protection, some dust and dirt protection. And it's just a procedure that they've worked out rather than willy-nilly in a box or under the arm or whatever. But a lot of it comes down to common sense. We just say, don't take the tape out of the vault, throw it in the trunk of your black car on a hot day, throw it on a deck and hit fast forward. It's gonna be cold, it's gonna be stiff, treat it a little gingerly. So a lot of it's just common sense. How about one or two more, and then I think we're running out of time and I have, yeah. Yes. Yes.
I want to ask you about splashing tape, which is a very important thing. But I have to tell you first, Iceland, where I come from, temperature outside seldom goes over 50 and the humidity over 30. But we have problems with earthquakes and volcanoes. But anyway, about splicing tape, you know, for many decades, 30, 40 years, the standard answer to make splices were the 3M permanent splicing tape. But now I hear all over from colleagues and friends that the supposedly permanent tape is behaving like the regular Scotch tape, is getting gooey and getting loose. Do you know if 3M has done anything to correct that or make amends for those guarantees?
The question is about splicing tape. I can't give you the latest word on splicing tape, but generally speaking, yes, when you lower the humidity to those low temperatures, you're going to have problems with bad splices. I don't have a good answer for that. I'm sorry. The question is, do we do disaster response? We're almost always filled to capacity, so we don't have big warehouses at those conditions that you could wheel things in. And most disaster response situations for, say, water damage or fire damage or things like that are using freeze drying or other techniques. And no, we don't get involved with that. But we do have lots of sources of those kinds of vendors on our website. There's a whole section about that. I'm just going to wrap up because we're running out of time, but I'll answer your questions individually. I'll be around for the rest of the conference. I'll just end with one anecdote, which could only have come from a vault, probably in Hollywood. Some of you may know a colleague of yours at UCLA by the name of Dan Einstein, who is the television archivist for the UCLA Film and Television Archives. I noticed a few of you are here from UCLA. Nice guy. They used to be a client of ours at the Vault until they built their own facility on campus. Dan is Albert Einstein's nephew, and you can see the resemblance when you meet him. And nice guy, and he used to always pop his head in the office if I was there and just say hello whenever he was accessing his vault, where he had a pretty extensive collection of videotape for their television archive. Well, one day, another client of ours happened to be in the office, and it was the estate of Abbott and Costello, the daughter and the son, Christine Costello, Chris the daughter, and Bud Abbott Jr., the son. And they were sitting in my office, and we were chatting about their account or something. And Dan pops his head in like he usually did and just, oh, hi. I said, oh, Dan, come on in. I want to introduce you to somebody, because I had a feeling Dan had some of the Abbott and Costello material in his collection anyway. So I introduced him, Dan Einstein, Chris Costello, Bud Abbott Jr., Dan Einstein. Pause. They look at each other. And Dan looks at them and said, are you related? And Chris looks back and said, are you? And Dan said, are you funny? And Bud Abbott Jr. says, are you brilliant? And we all cracked up just like that. only in Hollywood. Okay. There's some copies of that tape up here in front. You're welcome to grab one. If we run out, just give me your card and I'll send you one. They're NTSC. If anyone needs a PAL, I've got a handful of PALs as well.
What moved that clip with the skeleton and the girl? What the heck movie was that?
Yeah, I'm afraid to answer that.
He represents the skeleton.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, David Wexler.